seen in the cafeteria sitting cross-legged on a table chanting gibberish. Faye had heard stories about Alice, how she hitchhiked to Hyde Park on weekend nights, met boys, scored drugs, entered strange bedrooms, and emerged more complicated. "You're so quiet all the time," Alice said. "Always alone in your room. What are you doing there?"
"I don't know. I read."
"You read? What do you read?"
"Lots of things."
"You read your homework?"
"I guess."
"You read what your teachers tell you, get good grades."
Faye saw her up close now, her eyes bloodshot, hair tangled, clothes wrinkled and reeking, that funky cocktail of tobacco, pot, and perspiration.
Faye understood now that Alice had not yet slept. 6 in the morning and Alice had just returned from whatever free love odyssey these girls chased at night.
"I read poetry," Faye said.
"Yeah? What kind?"
"All kinds."
"Okay, say me a poem."
"Huh?"
"Say me a poem. Recite one. Should be easy if you read so much. Come on." There was a splotch on Alice's cheek that Faye had never noticed before. A trace of red and purple gathered just beneath the surface. A bruise.
"Are you okay?" Faye said. "Your face."
"I'm fine. Great. What's it to you?"
"Did someone hit you?"
"How about you mind your own business?"
"Fine," Faye said. "Never mind. I gotta go."
"You're not very friendly," Alice said. "Are you down on us or something?"
Those lyrics again. "Down on me." They played that damn song every night.
"Everybody in this whole round world." They sang it 4 or 5 off-key times in a row. "They're down on me," as if the girls needed them. All these other people in the world needed them to be down and thus give a reason for singing.
"No, I'm not down on you," Faye said. "I'm just not going to apologize to you."
"Apologize for what?"
"For doing my homework, being good at school. I'm sick of feeling bad about it. Good day."
Faye left the bathroom, flop-flopped back to her room, put on her clothes, and felt so full of poison and abstract anger that she sat on her bed and held her knees and rocked. She had a headache. She pulled her hair back and put on her big round glasses that looked to her suddenly like some elaborate Venetian disguise. She frowned into the mirror. She was gathering her books into her backpack when Alice knocked on the door.
"I'm sorry," Alice said. "That wasn't in the spirit of sisterhood. Please accept my apology."
"Forget it," Faye said. "Let me make it up to you. I'll take you out tonight. There's a meeting. I want you to come."
"I don't think that's necessary."
"It's sort of a secret. Don't tell anyone."
"Really, it's okay."
"I'll be here at 8, Alice said. "See you then." Faye closed the door and sat on her bed. She wondered what Alice had seen her doing back there in the shower when Faye had been thinking about Henry, his hands on her. What a treacherous thing a body was, how it so blatantly acted out the mind's secrets.
Henry's letter was hidden in her bedside table, in the bottom drawer, way in the back. She had tucked it inside a book. Paradise Lost.
2. They assembled in the office of the Chicago Free Voice, a small, irregularly printed handbill that called itself the Newspaper of the Street. Into a dark alley, through an unmarked door, up a narrow set of stairs, Alice led Faye to a room with a sign at the entrance that read, "Tonight, Women's Sexuality and Self-Defense." Alice tapped the sign with her finger and said,
"Two sides of the same coin, eh?"
She had not made any effort to hide the bruise on her cheek. The meeting had already begun when they arrived. The room, crowded with maybe 2 dozen women, smelled of tar and kerosene, old paper and dust. A warm mist of ink and glue and spirits hung in the air. Odors drifted in and out of perception, shoe polish, linseed oil, turpentine. The sting of solvents and oil reminded Faye of the garages and tool sheds of Iowa, where her uncle spent long afternoons fiddling with cars that hadn't been driven in decades, hot rods bought cheap at auctions and slowly restored, part by part, year by year, whenever the uncles could find time and motivation. But whereas her uncles decorated their garages with sports logos and pin-up girls, this office had a Viet Cong flag on the largest wall,
the smaller nooks covered with broadsides of past free-voice editions. "Chicago is a concentration camp," said one headline. "It is the year of the student," said another. "Fight the pigs in the street," and so on. A fine dark soot coated the walls and floor, a sheath of carbon that turned the light in the room to a gray-green smog. Faye's skin felt clammy and covered with grit, her sneakers quickly stained. The women sat in a circle, some on folding chairs, some leaning against the wall. White girls and black girls all wearing sunglasses and army jackets and combat boots. Faye sat down beside Alice and listened to the woman presently talking.
"You slap him," she said, a finger pointed into the air. "You bite him, you scream as loud as you can, and when you do, you scream fire. You break his kneecaps. Box his ears to pop his eardrums. Stiffen your fingers and jab his eyes out. Be creative. Ram his nose into his brain. Your keys and knitting needles can be weapons if held tightly. Find a nearby rock and bash his head in. If you know kung fu, use your kung fu. It goes without saying that you should be kneeing him in the groin repeatedly."
And women in the circle nodded, clapped, encouraged the speaker with "oh yeahs" and "right ons."
"Knee him in the groin and yell, 'You are not a man! Break his will! Men attack you because they think they can. Knee him in the groin and yell, 'You cannot do this! Don't rely on other men to help you. Every man in his heart wants you to be raped, because it confirms your need for his protection. Armchair rapists, that's what they are!'"
And Alice shouted, "Hell yeah!" And other women whooped, and Faye didn't know how to compose herself. She felt stiff and nervous, and she looked around at the women and tried to enact their casually bad posture while the speaker wrapped it up.
"Since men have their potency and masculinity vicariously confirmed through rape, they will never do anything to stop it, unless we force them to. So I say we take a stand. No more husbands. No more weddings. No more children. Not until rape is extinguished. Once and for all, a total reproductive boycott. We will grind civilization to a halt."
And to this, the woman got great applause, the others standing and patting her on the back. And Faye was about to join the ovation when from a far, dark corner of the room came a loud gnashing of metal. Everyone turned to look. And that's when Faye saw him for the first time. His name was Sebastian. He wore a white apron covered in pitch, smudged gray where he'd rubbed his hands, his shaggy bowl of black hair flopping in front of his eyes as he looked back sheepishly at the group and said, "Sorry." He stood behind a machine that seemed built like a train, all black cast metal, shining with oil, silver spindles and toothy gears. The machine hummed and vibrated, the occasional tock of metal falling down chutes somewhere in its innards, like pennies dropped onto a table. The man, he was young, olive-skinned, a hangdog look, pulled a sheet of paper from the machine, and Faye realized the contraption was a printing press, the sheet a copy of the Free Voice. Alice called out to him,
"Hey, Sebastian, what's cooking?" "Tomorrow's edition," he said, smiling, turning the paper to the light. "What's in it?"
"Letters to the editor. I had a stockpile."
"Are they good?"
"They'll blow your mind," he said, loading more paper onto the bed of the machine. "Sorry. Act normal. I'm not even here."
And so everyone turned back and the meeting began again, but Faye kept watching Sebastian. How he fiddled with knobs and cranks, how he lowered the head of the machine to smash ink onto the paper. How he pressed his lips together in concentration. How the collar on his white shirt had been stained a deep, dark green, and she was thinking about how he looked like some beautifully sloppy mad scientist, and how she felt connected to him in the way outsiders feel a certain kinship with each other when she heard someone in the group say something about orgasms. Faye turned to see who was speaking. Tall woman, blonde hair like a waterfall down to her back, a string of beads around her neck, a bright red shirt with a deep neckline. She was leaning forward and asking about orgasms. "Can you have them only in one position?" Faye could not believe she'd said such a thing with a boy in the room. Behind them, his machine punched at paper, throbbing like a heartbeat. Someone suggested that you could have orgasms in 2 and perhaps as many as 3 positions. Someone else said the orgasm was a fiction. It was invented by doctors to make us feel ashamed. Ashamed of what? That we don't have them like boys do? People nodded at this. They moved on. It was suggested you could orgasm on weed and sometimes acid, but almost never on heroin. Someone said sex on the natch was best anyway. One woman's boyfriend couldn't have sex unless he was drunk. Another woman's boyfriend had recently asked her to douche. There was a boyfriend who, after sex, spent an hour cleaning the bedroom with a mop and germicide. There was another boyfriend who named his dick Mr. Rumpy Pumpy. Another only wanted blowjobs until marriage. Free love, someone said, and everyone laughed. Because despite what the newspapers said, it was not the time of free love. It was the time of free love writing, when free love was widely condemned, rarely practiced, and terrifically marketed. Photos of topless women dancing in public in Berkeley were greatly criticized and distributed. News of the oral sex scandal at Yale reached every bedroom in the country. Everyone had heard of the Barnard girl who was living with a boy she wasn't even married to. The imagination was seized by the pelvic regions of university girls, stories of once chaste daughters turned to deviants in only one semester. Magazine articles condemned masturbation, the FBI warned against clitoral orgasm, and Congress investigated the dangers of fellatio. Never before had the authorities been so remarkably explicit. Mothers were taught the warning signs of sex addiction. Kids were counseled against criminal and soul-destroying pleasure. Police flew helicopters over beaches to catch bare-breasted women. Life magazine said slutty girls had penis envy and were turning real men into pansies. The New York Times said excessive fornication caused girls to go psychotic. Good middle-class kids were becoming queers, dopers, dropouts, beatniks. It was true. Heard it on Cronkite. Politicians vowed to get tough. They blamed the pill, permissive, liberal parents. The climbing divorce rate, raunchy movies, go-go clubs, atheism. People shook their heads, appalled at youth run amok, and then set out looking for more tawdry stories, found them, and read every word. The barometer for the health of the country seemed to be what middle-aged men thought about the behavior of college girls. But for the girls, it was not the time of free love. It was the time of awkward love, embarrassed and nervous and ignorant love. This is what nobody reported, how free love girls gathered in these dark rooms and worried. They'd read all the stories and believed them, and thus thought they were doing something wrong. I want to be hip, but I don't want my boyfriend fucking all these other women, said many, many girls who found that free love was still tangled up in all the old arguments, jealousy, envy, power. It was a sexual bait and switch. The free love trip not quite measuring up to its hype. If I don't want to have sex with someone, does that mean I'm a prude? Said one of the women at the meeting. If I don't want to strip at a protest, am I a prude? Said another. Men think you're a hip chick if you take your shirt off at rallies. All those nude girls in Berkeley holding flowers. They sell lots of papers. Posing with psychedelic paint on their tits. What kind of freedom is that? They're just doing it to be popular. They're not free. They're doing it for men. Why else would they do it? There's no other reason to do it. Maybe they like it, said a new voice. A small voice, and everyone looked to see where it had come from. The girl with the funny round glasses who had been unnaturally quiet up to this point. Faye's face flushed red and she looked at the floor. Alice turned around and stared at her. What do they like about it? She asked. Faye shrugged. She'd shocked herself by saying anything, much less that. She wanted to take it back immediately, reach out and stuff it into her stupid mouth. Maybe they like it. Oh, Lord. Oh, God. The girls looked at her and waited. She had the feeling of being a wounded bird in a room full of cats. Alice cocked her head and said, Do you like it? Sometimes. I don't know. No. She had forgotten herself. She had been caught up in the moment, all this talk of sex, all the girls so excited, and she imagined herself at home, standing in front of her big picture window, imagining some dark stranger walking by and seeing her. When this thing erupted, it just came out. Maybe they like it.
You like putting on a show for men? Alice asked. Parading your tits so they'll like you?
That's not what I meant.
What's your name? Someone asked.
Faye, she said, and the girls waited. They watched her. She wanted more than anything to run out of the room, but that would draw so much more attention. She sat in a tight ball trying to think of something to say, and that's when Sebastian stepped out from the shadows and saved her.
I'm sorry to interrupt, he said, but I have an announcement.
And as he talked, the group mercifully forgot about Faye. She sat there boiling and listening to Sebastian. He was talking about the upcoming protest, how the city hadn't given them a permit to occupy the park, but they were going to do it anyway.
Make sure to tell your friends, he said. Bring everybody. We're going to have 100,000 people or more. We're going to change the world. We're going to end the war. Nobody will go to work. Nobody will go to school. We're going to shut the city down. Music and dancing at every red light. The pigs can't stop us.
And at the mention of the pigs themselves laughed, for they were listening. They were packed into a small office several miles south called the War Room, in the basement of the International Amphitheater, where the detectives listened through static to Sebastian's exhortations, the girls' inane chatter. They wrote on legal pads and remarked on the stupidity of college kids, how they were so trusting. The office of the Chicago Free Voice had been bugged for how long now? How many months? The kids didn't have a clue. Outside the amphitheater were the slaughterhouses, the famous stockyards of Chicago, where the police heard the screams of animals, the last wails of cattle and hogs. Some of the cops, interested, peered over fences and saw carcasses torn off the ground by hooks and trolleys, pulled to death, dismembered, floors covered in entrails and shit, men hacking tirelessly at limbs and throats. It all seemed appropriate. The butcher's curved knives offered the police a kind of clarity, a kind of purity of intent that gave their jobs a helpful, if unspoken, guiding metaphor. They listened and wrote down anything, any indictable threat, calls to violence, outside agitating communist propaganda, and tonight they were given something special. A name. One never mentioned before. Someone new. Faye. They glanced over at the new guy standing in the corner, legal pad in hand, recently promoted from beat cop to the Red Squad, Officer Charlie Brown. He nodded. He wrote it down. The Red Squad was the Chicago PD's covert anti-terrorist intelligence unit that was created in the 1920s to spy on union organizers, expanded in the 1940s to spy on communists, and concentrated now on threats to the domestic peace posed by radical leftists, mostly the students and the blacks. It was a glamorous job, and Brown was aware that some of the other officers, the older officers, were skeptical of him and his promotion. He was young, nervous as all hell, had a brief career that as yet lacked distinction. He had, so far, mostly busted screwed-up hippie kids for minor infractions, loitering, jaywalking, curfew. The vague statute against public lewdness. His goal as a beat cop was to become such an annoyance they simply gave up, the hippies, gave up and moved along to some other precinct, or better, some other city. Then Chicago wouldn't have to deal with what was roundly agreed to be the worst generation ever. Easily the worst, even though it was his generation too. He wasn't much older than the kids he busted, but the uniform made him feel older. The uniform and crew cut and wife and child and preference for quiet things like bars without too much music, where the only thing you heard was the murmur of conversation and the occasional sharp thwack of billiard balls. And church. Going to church and seeing the other beat cops there. It was a brotherhood. They were Catholic guys, neighborhood guys. You slapped them on the back when you saw them. They were good guys. They drank, but not too much. They were kind to their wives, fixed up their houses, built things, played poker, paid their mortgages. Their wives knew each other. Their kids played together. They'd been living on the block since forever. Their fathers had lived here, grandfathers too. They were Irish, Poles, Germans, Czechs, Swedes, but now thoroughly Chicagoans. They had city pensions that made them a good catch for the neighborhood ladies looking to settle down. They loved each other, loved the city, loved America, and not in an abstract way like kids asked to pledge allegiance, but way down to their core, because they were happy. They were doing it, living, being successful, working hard, raising kids, sending kids to goddamn school. They had watched their own fathers raise them, and like most boys, they worried about measuring up. But here they were, doing it, and they thanked God and America and the city of Chicago for it. They hadn't asked for much, but what they'd asked for, they'd gotten. It was hard not to feel personal about all this. When some new bad element moved into the neighborhood, it was hard not to take it personally. It was personal. Officer Brown's own grandfather had moved to this neighborhood as a very young man. He was Czeslaw Bronikowski, until he reached Ellis Island, where he was given the name Charles Brown, a name then bestowed on the family's firstborn sons each generation since. And even though Officer Brown could have done without the teasing this name prompted when kids began reading that goddamn comic strip circa first grade, still he loved it. It was a good name, an American name, a consolidation of his family's past and its future. It was a name that fit in. So when some out-of-town doper, some punk peacenik, some long-haired hippie freak sat on the sidewalk all day scaring the daylights out of the old ladies, it was indeed personal. Why couldn't they just fit in? With the Negroes, it was at least reasonable. If the blacks didn't particularly appreciate America, well, he could wrap his head around that one. But these kids, these middle-class white kids with their anti-America slogans, what gave them the right? And so his job was simple. Target and annoy the bad elements in the city as far as the law allowed. As far as he could go without risking his pension or publicly embarrassing the city or the mayor. And yeah, sometimes somebody appeared on TV, usually some East Coast idiot with no idea what the fuck he was talking about, who said the cops in Chicago were harsh or brutal or obstructing people's First Amendment rights. But nobody paid much attention to that. There was a saying, Chicago problems, Chicago solutions. For example, if a beatnik was walking through his precinct at 2 o'clock in the morning, it was a pretty easy matter to bust him for curfew violation. It was well known that most of these types did not carry any form of identification. So when they said, "The curfew doesn't apply to me, pig," he could say, "Prove it." And they absolutely could not. Simple. So they spent an uncomfortable few hours in a holding pen while the message sunk in. You are not welcome here. And that had been an acceptable job for Officer Brown. He was aware of his own talents and limitations. He was not ambitious. He was content as a beat cop until, almost by accident, he got to know and earn the trust of a certain hippie leader. And when he told his bosses that he had made contact with a leading student radical and now had access to the underground's inner sanctum and asked to be assigned to the Red Squad, specifically the division investigating anti-American activity at Chicago Circle, they reluctantly agreed. Nobody else in the force had been able to infiltrate Circle. Those college kids could sniff out a fake easy. The Red Squad wiretapped rooms and telephones. They took covert photos. They tried to be as generally disruptive as they could be to the anti-war fringe. He saw it as a simple amplification of what he did on the street, annoying and detaining hippies. Only now it was done in secret, using tactics that pushed the boundaries of what was, at face value, legal. For example, they raided the Office of Students for a Democratic Society, stole files, broke typewriters, and spray-painted black power on the walls to throw the kids off. That seemed a bit questionable, yes, but the way he thought about it was that the only change between his old job and his new one was the method. The moral calculus, he figured, was the same. Chicago problems, Chicago solutions. And now he had been given the gift of a new name to investigate. Some new fringe element recently arrived at Circle. He wrote the name down in his notebook. Put a star next to it. He would get to know this Faye very soon. 3. Faye outdoors in the grass, back leaning against a building in the shade of a small campus tree, gently placed the newspaper on her lap. She smoothed its crinkles. She bent the corners where they'd begun to curl. The paper did not feel like ordinary newsprint, stiffer, thicker, almost waxy. Ink smeared off the page and onto her fingertips. She wiped her hands on the grass. She looked at the masthead, editor-in-chief, Sebastian, and she smiled. There was something both brazen and triumphant about Sebastian using only his first name. He had achieved enough renown that he was publicly mononymous, like Plato or Voltaire or Stendhal or Twiggy. She opened the paper. It was the edition Sebastian had been printing last night, full of letters to the editor. She began to read. Dear Chicago Free Voice, do you like hiding from the pigs and those other people that stare at us, put us down, because of our clothes and hair? I mean, I used to be, but I don't anymore. I talk to them. Get them to like me and become friends, and then tell them I smoke grass. And if they like you, they might smoke it with you sometime and listen. You will help add one more of us to our ever-growing number. I think 50% of the USA is doing it, and narcotics officers think we're all mental patients, ha-ha. It was hot today, and bright and buggy. The gnats dove into her face, black dots between her eyes and the page, as if the punctuation marks were fleeing. She shooed them away. She was alone, nobody around. She found a quiet little spot on the northeast part of campus, a patch of grass separated from the sidewalk by a small hedge, back behind the brand-new Behavioral Sciences building, which was roundly the most loathed building on the entire Circle campus. This was the one all the brochures talked about, designed according to the geometric principles of field theory, a new architecture meant to break the old architecture's tyranny of the square, the brochures had said. A modern architecture that abandoned the square in favor of an overlapping matrix of octagons inscribed by circles. Why this was better philosophically than a square, the brochures never explained, but Faye could guess. A square was old, traditional, antique, and therefore bad. It seemed to Faye that the worst thing on this campus for both the students and the buildings was to be square. So the Behavioral Sciences building was modern, many-angled, which in practice made the place a bewildering mess. The interconnected honeycombs made no intuitive sense, hallways jagged and serpentine so you couldn't walk 10 feet without having to make some kind of navigational choice. Faye's poetry class met here, and simply finding the correct classroom was an ordeal that taxed both her patience and her sense of spatial awareness. Certain stairs led into literally nothing, just a wall or a locked door, while other stairs led down to tiny landings where several other staircases intersected, all of them identical looking. What seemed like a dead end actually opened into an entirely new area she never would have predicted was there. The third floor was visible from the second floor, with no obvious way to get up to it. That everything was built in circles and oblique angles pretty much guaranteed anyone would get lost, and indeed all who encountered this building for the first time had the same baffled expression, trying to navigate a place where concepts like left and right had little meaning. It seemed less a place where students would study the behavioral sciences, and more a place where behavioral scientists would study the students, to see how long the students could endure this nonsensical environment before going completely berserk. So mostly the students avoided it, if they could, which made it a good place for Faye to be alone and read. Do you people out there think you're crazy? I mean, you're part of those 50%ers, right? I mean, you all smoke grass, don't you? I do, and I work hard or almost as hard as anyone else at the post office. And all my fellow workers know I turn on. I mean, they're always asking me if some box of tea smells like grass. Today I found one that did, and most of them wanted to smell it. Then we wrapped it up and delivered it. That person who got it might have gotten it by now. He might be enjoying his package. He might be reading my rap. Hello, friend. Movement in the distance distracted her, and she looked up, worried. Because if any of her teachers saw her reading the Chicago Free Voice, if any of the college officials who administrated her scholarship saw her reading the pro-narcotic, pro-Viet Cong, anti-establishment newspaper of the street, well, they would think certain unfortunate things about her. So her head popped out of reading at the first peripheral sight of the approaching figure, walking down the sidewalk on the other side of the hedge. And she gathered at a glance that he was no teacher, no administrator. His hair was too big for that. Moppy was the word going around, but his hair had gone well beyond moppy and into a kind of efflorescence. wild growth. She watched him come, her head bent into the newspaper so it wouldn't look like she was staring, and as he approached, his features clarified and she realized she knew him. He was the boy from last night. At the meeting. Sebastian. She pushed her hair back and wiped the sweat off her forehead. She lifted the newspaper to conceal her face, pressed her back into the wall and felt thankful that the building had so many overhangs and corners. Maybe he'd walk by.
I'd rather smoke a joint with a pig than keep on running from him. I mean, wouldn't you? I mean, wouldn't you like it if everybody did? No fights, no wars, just a bunch of happy people. Wild thought, or is it?
Her head buried in the newspaper, she recognized this as a somewhat pathetic, ostrich-like maneuver. She could hear Sebastian's footsteps in the grass. Her face felt 10 degrees warmer. She felt the sweat on her temples and smeared it off with her fingers. She squeezed the newspaper and held it close.
How would you people, my people, like to all, and I mean all, get together? I mean at least 10 million people, well, maybe 9 million. I'd sure like to shake all you good people's hands out there. All we need is some place to have a huge turn-on festival and let them know how many of us there really are.
The footsteps stopped, then started again and came closer. He was walking toward her now, and Faye breathed and wiped the moisture from her forehead and waited. He approached, maybe 10 feet away, maybe 5. The paper blocked her, but she sensed him there. It would be absurd to pretend otherwise. She lowered the paper and saw him smiling.
"Hello, Faye," he said.
He bounced over and sat down beside her.
"Sebastian," she said,
and she nodded and smiled her most genuine feeling smile.
He looked handsome, professional, even. He seemed pleased she'd remembered his name.
The mad scientist lab coat was gone. Now he was in a proper jacket, neutral beige, corduroy, and a plain white shirt, thin navy blue tie, brown slacks. He looked presentable, acceptable, except maybe the hair. Too long, too disheveled, too big. But good boy material, nonetheless. One that could be, in his current state, maybe even furnished to parents.
"Your newspaper is quite good," Faye said,
already working out how to be maximally likable in this moment, how to ingratiate herself to him, be supportive, be full of praise. "That letter from the man at the post office, I really think he has a point. It's quite interesting."
"Oh, Lord, can you imagine that guy organizing a festival? 10 million people? Yeah, right."
"I don't think he really wants to organize a festival," Faye said. "I think he wants to know he's not alone. He just seems lonely to me."
Sebastian gave her a look of mock surprise, cocked his head and raised an eyebrow and smiled. "I thought he was nuts," he said.
"No, he's looking for people he can be himself around, aren't we all?"
"Huh," Sebastian said and stared at her for a moment. "You're different, aren't you?"
"I don't know what you mean."
She wiped the sweat off her forehead.
"You're sincere," Sebastian said.
"I am?"
"Quiet, but sincere. You don't talk much, but when you talk, you say what you mean. Most people I know talk constantly, but never say anything true."
"Thanks.
Also, you have ink all over your face."
"What?"
"Ink," he said. "All over."
She looked at her fingertips, blackened by the newspaper, and put it together.
"Oh, no," she said.
She reached into her backpack for her cosmetics. She flipped open the compact, looked into the mirror, and saw what had happened. Dark black streaks across her forehead, cheeks, temples, exactly where her fingers wiped away the sweat. And this was the kind of moment that could wreck her whole day, the kind of moment that would usually summon the tightness, the panic, doing something foolish in front of a stranger. But something else happened instead. Something surprising. Faye did not have an episode. Instead, she laughed.
"I look like a Dalmatian," she said.
And she laughed. She didn't know why she was laughing.
"It's my fault," Sebastian said. He handed her a handkerchief. "I should use better ink."
She rubbed away the smudges.
"Yes," she said, "it is your fault."
"Walk with me," he said. And he helped her up and they left the shade of the tree, Faye's face now clean and bright.
"You're fun," he said.
She felt weightless, happy, a little flirty even. It was the first time in her life anyone had ever described her as fun. She said, "You have a good memory, mister."
"I do?"
"You remembered my name," she said.
"Oh, well, you made an impression. That thing you said at the meeting."
"I wasn't thinking. I just blurted it out."
"You were right, though. It was an important point."
"It was not.
You were suggesting that sometimes what people want sexually is in conflict with what they want politically, which made everyone uncomfortable. Plus, that group tends to pounce on shy people. It looked like you were in trouble."
"I'm not shy," she said. "It's just..." And she stopped to find the right word, the correct and comprehensible way to say it, then skipped the explanation altogether. "Thanks for speaking up," she said. "I appreciate it."
"It's no problem," Sebastian said. "I saw your mar."
"My what?"
"Your mar."
"What is a mar?"
"I learned about it in Tibet," he said, "visiting this sect of monks, one of the oldest Buddhist groups on earth. Met them while I was abroad. I wanted to meet them because they've solved the problem of human empathy."
"I didn't know that was a problem needing to be solved."
"Oh, sure. The problem is we can never really feel it, empathy. Most people think empathy is like understanding someone else or relating to them, but it's more than that. Real empathy is the actual corporeal feeling of someone else's emotions, so that it's experienced not only in the brain, but also in the body. The body vibrating like a tuning fork to the sadness and suffering of another. As in, for example, you cry at the funerals of people you never even knew. You feel actual physical hunger when you see a starving child. You get vertigo when you watch an acrobat, and so forth."
Sebastian glanced at Faye to see if she was interested.
"Go on," she said.
"Okay. Well, if we follow this to its conclusion, then empathy becomes like a haunting. A condition that is impossible since we all have separate egos. We've attained individuation. We can never really be another person, and that's the great empathy problem. That we can approach it, but cannot realize it.
Like the speed of light."
"Exactly. Nature has certain boundaries, perfect human empathy being one of them, that will always be slightly beyond our reach. But the monks have solved the problem this way. The mar."
Faye listened in wonder that a boy was saying such things to her. Nobody had ever spoken to her this way. She wanted to wrap her arms around him and cry.
"Think of the mar as the seat of emotions," Sebastian said, "held deeply inside your body, somewhere near the stomach. All desire, all yearning, all feelings of love and compassion and lust, all of one's secret wants and needs are held in the mar."
Faye placed her palm on her belly.
"Yeah," Sebastian said, smiling, "right there. To see someone's mar means recognizing someone else's desire, without asking, without being told, and acting on it. That last part is essential. The seeing is not complete until one does something about it. So a man only sees a woman's desires when he fulfills them without being asked to do so. A woman sees a hungry man's mar when, unprompted, she gives him food."
"Okay," Faye said, "I get it."
"It's this active sense of empathy that I love so much. The sense that one must do more than quietly relate to another human. One must also make something happen."
"Empathy is achieved only by deed," Faye said.
"Yes. So at the meeting, when I saw the group begin to criticize you, I turned their attention away, and in this way I saw your mar."
And Faye was about to thank him when they came to a clearing, and ahead of her she saw people, heard chanting. She'd been hearing some slight noise during their walk as they moseyed counterclockwise around the Behavioral Sciences building, taking the zigzagging route necessary on a campus that had few direct paths from anywhere to anywhere. It had grown louder as Sebastian told his story of empathy and monks and seeing her mar.
"What's that sound?" she said.
"Oh, that's the demonstration."
"What demonstration?"
"You don't know?"
There are posters up everywhere.
I guess I didn't notice.
It's the Chemstar protest, he said, and they emerged into the courtyard of the monolithic University Hall, the tallest, most intimidating building on campus by far. Whereas most of Circle's buildings were squat, three-story things, University Hall was a 30-story monster. It was visible from everywhere, looming over the trees, fatter at the top than at the bottom, anonymous, boxy, tyrannical. It looked like a beige concrete exoskeleton had been scaffolded around a slightly smaller, slightly browner building. Like every other campus structure, this one had narrow windows too small to fit a body through. Except, that is, for the top floor. The only windows on the entire campus that looked big enough to jump through were located suspiciously, almost invitingly, on the campus's highest point, the top floor of University Hall. And this fact struck some of the more cynical students as malevolent and sinister. Here, dozens of students were on the march. Bearded, long-haired, angry, they shouted at the building, shouted at the people inside the building, administrators, bureaucrats, the university president, holding signs that showed the Chemstar logo dripping with blood. That Chemstar logo Faye knew so well. It was stitched brightly on the uniform her father wore to work. Right there on the chest, the logo's interlocking CNS. What's wrong with Chemstar, she said. They make napalm, Sebastian said. They kill women and children.
They do not.
It's true, Sebastian said. And the university buys their cleaning products, which is why we're protesting.
They make napalm, she said. Her father never mentioned this. In fact, he never talked about work at all. Never said what he did there.
It's a benzene and polystyrene compound, Sebastian explained. That, when jellified and mixed with gasoline, becomes a sticky, highly flammable syrup that's used to burn the skin off the Viet Cong.
I know what napalm is, Faye said. I just didn't know Chemstar made it.
That Faye's childhood and education were funded by paychecks from Chemstar was something she could not bear to tell Sebastian now, or ever. Sebastian, meanwhile, watched the protest. He had not seemed to notice her anxiety. He had stopped seeing her mar. Rather, he watched the two journalists on the periphery of the mob, a writer and a photographer. The writer wasn't writing anything, and the photographer wasn't shooting.
Not enough people showed up, he said. It won't get in the newspaper.
The crowd was maybe three dozen strong and loud and walking in a circle holding signs and chanting, "Murderers! Murderers!"
A few years ago, Sebastian said, dozen picketing people would get you a few inches on page six. But now, after so many protests, the criteria have changed. Each new protest makes the next protest more usual. It's the great flaw of journalism. The more something happens, the less newsworthy it is. We have to follow the same trajectory as the stock market. Sustained and unstoppable growth.
Faye nodded. She was thinking about the Chemstar billboard back home. Making our dreams come true.
I guess there's one way to make sure it gets into the paper, Sebastian said.
What's that?
Someone has to be arrested. Works every time.
He turned to her.
It's been very nice talking to you, Faye, he said.
Thank you, she said, distractedly, for she was still thinking about her father, about the way he smelled when he came home from work. Like gasoline and something else, some heavy and suffocating smell. Like car exhaust, hot asphalt.
I hope to see you again soon, Sebastian said, and then he took off running toward the crowd.
Startled, Faye cried, "Wait!" But he kept going. Sprinting toward a police car parked near the mob, he bounded onto its hood, leaped onto the roof, and raised both fists into the air. The students cheered wildly. The photographer began shooting. Sebastian jumped up and down, denting the top of the car, then turned and looked at Faye. He smiled at her and held her gaze until the police reached him, which they did quickly, and wrestled him down and put him in handcuffs and took him away.
4.
When Sebastian landed on the police car, he landed hard. On his jaw.
The police were brutal. Faye imagined him in jail right now, a lump of bruise. He would need someone to rub ice on that jaw, maybe change a bandage, massage a sore back. Faye wondered if he had someone who could do that for him, someone special. She found herself hoping he did not. Her schoolwork was spread out across her bed. She was reading Plato, The Republic, the Dialogues. She had finished the required reading, had swallowed everything about Plato's allegorical cave, the allegorical people living in the allegorical cave and seeing only shadows of the real world, and believing the shadows were the real world. Plato's basic point being that our map of reality and actual reality sometimes do not match. She had finished the homework and was reading the only chapter in the whole book the professor had not assigned, which seemed curious. But now, halfway through reading it, Faye understood. In this chapter, Socrates was teaching a bunch of old men how to attract very young boys. For sex. What was his advice? Never praise the boy, Socrates said. Do not attempt romance. Do not sweep him off his feet. When you praise a beautiful boy, he said, the boy is filled with such a high opinion of himself that he becomes more difficult to catch. You are a hunter who shoos your prey away. The person who calls an attractive person attractive only becomes more ugly. Better not to praise him at all. Better, maybe, to be a little mean. Faye wondered if that was true. She knew every time Henry called her beautiful, she tended to think he was more pathetic. She hated this about herself, but maybe Socrates was right. Maybe desire was best left unspoken. She didn't know. Sometimes Faye wished she lived another life parallel to this one, a life exactly the same but for the choices she made. In this other life, she wouldn't have to worry so much. She could say anything, do anything, kiss boys and not worry about her reputation, watch movies with abandon, stop obsessing about tests or homework, shower with the other girls, wear far-out clothes and sit at the hippie table for kicks. In this other, more interesting life, Faye would live consequence-free, and it seemed beautiful and lovely and, as soon as she thought about it objectively for 10 seconds, ridiculous. Totally beyond her reach. Which was why today's great success, her pleasant and honest embarrassment with Sebastian, was such a breakthrough. That she'd embarrassed herself in front of a boy and laughed about it? That she had smeared ink all over her face and didn't react with horror, did not yet feel horror, was not obsessing over it right now, was not disgusted by it, was not replaying it, reliving it again and again. She needed to know more about Sebastian, she decided. She didn't know what she'd say, but she needed to know more. And she knew where to go. Alice lived next door, in a corner suite by the fire exit, a spot that had become a haven for far-out students, mostly women, mostly of the kind Faye had encountered at the meeting, who stayed up late screaming to the record player and smoking grass. When Faye peeked into the room, the door was almost always open, several faces swiveled to look at her, none of them Alice's. They suggested she might be found at People's Law, where Alice held an unpaid position keeping the books. "What's People's Law?" Faye asked, and the girls looked at each other and smirked. Faye realized she'd embarrassed herself, that the question revealed she was square. This happened to her all the time. "They help people arrested for protesting," one of the girls explained. "Help them get out of jail," another added. "Oh," Faye said. "Would they be able to help Sebastian?" They smiled again. The same way, some new conspiracy, another bit of the world, obvious to everyone but Faye. "No," said one of the girls. "He has his own methods. You don't have to worry about Sebastian. He gets arrested. He's back out in an hour. No one knows how he does it." "He's a magician," another of the girls added. They gave her the address of People's Law, which turned out to be a hardware store crammed into the first floor of a creaky and hot two-story apartment building. A building that might have seen a previous existence as a resplendent Victorian home, but had since been cut up into this live-work-retail puzzle. Faye looked for some kind of sign or door, but only found shelves crammed with your typical hardware things, nails, hammers, hoses. She wondered if the girls had given her the wrong address, if they were putting her on. The wooden floor squeaked, and she felt how it rippled and sloped down toward the heaviest shelves. She was about to leave when the proprietor, a tall and thin white-haired man, asked if he could help her find anything. "I'm looking for People's Law," she said. He looked at her for an uncomfortable moment, seemed to inspect her.
"You?" he said at last.
"Yes, is it here?"
He told her it was in the basement of the building, accessible through a door out back via the alley. So Faye found herself tapping on a wooden door with a simple PL painted on it in an alley that was empty, save for about half a dozen dumpsters cooking in the sun. The woman who answered, probably no older than Faye herself, said she hadn't seen Alice that day, but suggested Faye could find her at a place called Freedom House. And thus Faye had to endure the whole ritual again, the admission that she did not in fact know what Freedom House was, the awkward look, the embarrassment at not knowing something everyone else knew, the explanation from the girl telling her that Freedom House was a shelter for runaway girls, and that Faye was forbidden to give her location to any man ever. So this is how Faye discovered Alice in an otherwise unremarkable three-story brick building, in an unmarked top-floor apartment accessible only if you knew the secret knock, which, by the way, was Morse code for SOS. In a Spartan living room decorated mostly with mismatched and obviously second-hand or donated furniture, made more inviting and homey by various crocheted and knitted things, where Alice was sitting on the couch, her legs up on the edge of a coffee table, reading Playboy magazine.
"Why are you reading Playboy magazine?" Faye asked.
Alice gave her that impatient, withering stare that announced exactly how little she cared about stupid questions.
"For the articles," she said. The thing that made Alice so frightening was that she did not seem to care if she was liked. She did not seem to spend any mental energy accommodating other people, accounting for their wishes, expectations, desires, their basic need for decorum and manners and etiquette. And Faye's opinion was that everyone should want to be liked, not out of vanity, but because wanting to be liked provided an essential social lubricant. In a world without a vengeful god, the desire to be liked and to fit in was the only check on human behavior, it seemed to Faye, who wasn't sure if she believed in a vengeful god, but knew for a fact that Alice and her cronies were atheists to the bone. They could be as rude as they cared to be and not worry about retribution in the afterlife. It was disarming, like being in the same room with a large and unpredictable dog, that constant latent fear of it. Alice sighed heavily, like this was going to be a huge mental burden, this talking. It was almost as if Alice expected Faye to waste her time, and it was up to Faye to prove otherwise.
"Look at this woman," Alice said.
She kicked her feet to the floor and laid the magazine on the coffee table and opened it to the centerfold. The photo, vertically oriented, took up three full pages, and once Faye got over the initial shock, that first somersault in her belly when she found herself looking at something she was sure she wasn't allowed to see, the first thing she thought, tilting her head so she could see better, was that the young woman in the photo looked cold. Physically cold. She was standing in a swimming pool, her back turned at a slight angle to the camera, twisting at the waist so that her torso was in profile. She was standing in perfectly turquoise water and hugging a child's inflatable swimming pool toy, a blow-up swan, hugging it around its long neck, pressing it against her cheek as if she might find warmth there. Of course she was nude. The skin of her butt and lower back appeared rough and coarse, a crocodile skin from the goosebumps popping up all over. Beads of water dribbled off her butt and upper thigh where she had dipped a few inches into the water, but no farther.
"What am I looking at here?" Faye said.
"Pornography."
"Yes, but why?"
"I think she's very pretty, this one."
The centerfold girl, Miss August, it said in the corner. Her pink body was mottled a slight maroon in places where she was cold or where the blood showed under her skin. Water streaked down her back, a few drops clung to her arm, not enough to look like she'd really been swimming. Maybe the photographer had spritzed her for effect.
"There's an ease to her," Alice said, "a quiet charm. I'll bet she's capable, powerful even. Problem is, she has no idea what she can do."
"But you like her looks."
"She's beautiful."
"I read somewhere that you shouldn't compliment people's looks," Faye said. "It diminishes you."
Alice frowned.
"Says who?"
"Socrates, via Plato."
"You know," Alice said,
You're way strange sometimes. Sorry. You don't have to apologize for it. Miss August was not quite smiling. Rather, she had that mechanically forced smile of someone who's very cold being told to smile. Her face was summer freckled. Two drops of water hung from her right breast. If they fell, they would land on her bare belly. Faye could feel it, that chill.
Porn is a problem for the whole project of enlightenment, Alice said. If otherwise rational, educated, literate, moral, and ethical men still need to look at this, then how far have we really come? The conservative wants to get rid of pornography by banning it, but the liberal wants to get rid of it too by making people so enlightened they no longer want it. Repression versus education. The cop and the teacher both have the same goal, prudishness, but use different tools.
All my uncles subscribe, they said, pointing to the magazine. They leave it out in the open. They put it on the coffee table.
They say the sexual revolution is not really about sex, but about shame.
This girl does not appear to be ashamed, said Faye.
This girl does not appear to be anything. It's not her shame we're talking about, it's ours.
You feel ashamed?
By ours, I mean the general we, the abstract we.
Oh.
The capital V viewer, capital L looker. Not us in particular, you or I.
I feel ashamed, Faye said. A little, I guess. I don't want to, but I do.
And why is that?
I don't want anyone to know I've seen this. They might think I'm weird.
Define weird.
That I was looking at girls. They might think I like girls.
And you're worried about what they think.
Of course I am.
That's not real shame. You think it's shame, but it's not.
What is it?
Fear.
Okay.
Self-hatred, alienation, loneliness.
Those are just words.
There was also the odd fact of it, the magazine sitting there between them, its objectness. The creases in the photo, the undulations of the pages, the way the gloss of the magazine reflected the light, the curling paper's sensitivity to humid air. One of the staples holding the magazine together erupted out of Miss August's arm as if she'd been struck by shrapnel. The windows in the apartment were open, a small electric fan whirred nearby, and the centerfold pages bounced and shimmied in the shifting air, animating it. It looked like Miss August was moving, twitching, trying to hold still in the cold water but not able to.
"The men in the movement say this shit all the time," said Alice. "Like, if you don't want to fuck them, they wonder why you have such big hang-ups. If you won't take off your shirt, they tell you not to be so ashamed of yourself. Like, if you don't let them feel your tits, you're not a legitimate part of the movement."
"Does Sebastian do that?" Alice stopped and squinted at her.
"Why do you want to know about Sebastian?"
"No reason. I'm curious, is all."
"Curious? He seems to be, you know, interesting."
"Interesting how?"
"We had a nice afternoon together. Today. On the lawn."
"Oh, Lord."
"What?"
"You dig him."
"Do not.
You're thinking about him."
"He seems interesting, that's all."
"Do you want to ball him?"
"I would not phrase it like that."
"You want to fuck him. But you want to make sure he's worthy first. That's why you came here today, to ask about Sebastian."
"We simply had a pleasant conversation, and then he was arrested at the Chemstar protest, and now I'm worried about him. I'm worried about my friend."
Alice leaned forward, put her elbows on her knees.
"Don't you have a boyfriend back home?"
"I don't see how that's relevant."
"But you do, right? Girls like you always do. Where is he right now? Is he waiting for you?"
"He's in the army."
"Oh, wow," Alice said, clapping her hands together. "Oh, that's rich. Your boyfriend's going to Vietnam and you want to screw a war protester."
"Never mind."
"And not just any war protester, the war protester."
Alice clapped a mocking applause.
"Be quiet,"
Faye said.
"Sebastian's got a Viet Cong flag on his wall. He gives money to the National Liberation Front. You know that, right?"
"This is none of your business."
"Your boyfriend is going to get shot, and Sebastian will have supplied the bullets. This is who you choose."
Faye stood up.
"I'm going to leave now.
You might as well pull the trigger yourself, Alice said. That's low.
Faye turned her back to Alice and marched out of the apartment, her hands balled up in fists, her arms straight and rigid.
Now this is it, Alice called after her. Shame, real shame, this is how it feels, girly.
The last thing Faye saw as she slammed the door shut was Alice kicking her feet back up on the coffee table and flipping the pages of Playboy magazine. 5.
No cab fare, no train tokens. Alice believed in freedom, free movement, being free. Here at 5 o'clock in the morning, walking in the purple and cool and damp light of Chicago. The sun was beginning to show over Lake Michigan, and the faces of buildings glowed weakly pink. Certain delis were opening, and shopkeepers hosed off the sidewalks, where batches of newspapers tossed from trucks landed in heaps like sacks of grain. She looked at one and saw the headline, Nixon nominated by GOP, and she spat. She inhaled the early morning scent of the city, its waking breath, asphalt and engine oil. The shopkeepers ignored her. They saw her clothes, her big green military jacket and leather boots, her ripped-up skin-tight jeans, and they saw her black rumpled hair, her unimpressed eyes leveled over silver sunglasses, and they assumed correctly she was not a paying customer. She carried no cash. She did not warrant being courteous to. She liked the transparency of these interactions, the lack of bullshit between herself and the world. She didn't carry a purse because if she carried a purse, she might be tempted to put keys in the purse. And if she had keys, she might be tempted to lock her door. And if she began locking her door, she might be tempted to buy things that needed locking up. Clothes purchased at actual stores rather than hand-sewn or shoplifted. That's where it would begin. Then shoes, dresses, jewelry, stockpiles of collectible doodads, then still more stuff. A television, small.